You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight. Republicans on Friday, 28th of May, blocked the creation of an independent commission to investigate the 6th of January Capitol riot, using their filibuster power in the Senate for the first time this year to doom a full accounting of the deadliest attack on Congress in centuries. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Nicholas Fandos and Emily Cochrane. The piece is titled, Senate Republicans Filibuster 6th of January Inquiry Bill Blocking an Investigation. Republicans on Friday, 28th of May, blocked the creation of an independent commission to investigate the 6th of January Capitol riot, using their filibuster power in the Senate for the first time this year to doom a full accounting of the deadliest attack on Congress in centuries. The vote was a stark display of political self-interest by Republicans determined to shield themselves from an inquiry that could have publicly tarnished their party. They feared an investigation that would remind voters of the consequences of former President Donald Trump's election lies and how Republican lawmakers indulged them, spurring their supporters to violence. Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader, has made a clear choice that his and his party's fortunes depend on putting the events of 6th of January behind them. It all but guaranteed that there would be no comprehensive nonpartisan inquiry into the attack's root causes, the former President Donald Trump's conduct, as his supporters threatened lawmakers and the vice president, or any connections between his allies in Congress and the rioters. While members of both political parties agreed in its immediate aftermath that an investigation was indeed needed, most Republicans have since toiled to put the episode behind them, and some have actively sought to deny or to play down the reality of what happened on 6th of January. On Friday, 28th of May, only six Republicans joined Democrats to support advancing the measure to create an independent commission. The final vote, 54 to 35, fell short of the 60 votes needed to move past a Republican filibuster. The vote was a stinging defeat for proponents of the commission. They had argued that the only way to assemble a truly complete account of the rioting for a polarized nation was through an inquiry modeled after the one into the 11th of September 2001 attacks, in which outside experts with subpoena power undertook a thorough study. Some Republicans expressed disgust with their own party for blocking it, saying that they had put politics over the finding of what promised to be a grim set of facts. "I don't want to know, but I need to know," said Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, one of six Republicans who voted to form the commission. "To be making a decision for short-term political gain at the expense of understanding and acknowledging what was in front of us on 6th of January, I think we need to look at that critically." While the Justice Department has opened hundreds of criminal cases against rioters, and congressional committees are likely to expand nascent inquiries, they will almost certainly confront limits that a commission staffed with national security experts, jointly appointed by Republicans and Democrats, would not. Among them are partisanship, defiant witnesses, and turf wars that are likely to leave unanswered key questions about how the party rallied around Donald Trump's stolen election lies and his demands that Republicans invalidate Joseph Biden Jr.'s victory. "Do my Republican colleagues remember that day?" Senator Chuck Schumer, a Democrat of New York and a majority leader in the Senate, asked moments after the vote. "Do my Republican colleagues remember the savage mob calling for the execution of former Vice President Mike Pence, the makeshift gallows outside the Capitol? Shame on the Republican Party for trying to sweep the horrors of that day under the rug because they're afraid of Donald Trump," he added. Top Republicans had entertained supporting the measure as recently as last week, but they ultimately reversed course, and the House approved it with only 35 Republican votes. Leaders concluded that open-ended scrutiny of the attack would hand Democrats powerful political ammunition before the 2022 midterm elections and enrage a former president they are intent on appeasing. "I do not believe the additional extraneous commission that Democratic leaders want would uncover crucial new facts or promote healing," Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader in the Senate, said on the eve of the vote. Mitch McConnell added, "Frankly, I do not believe it is even designed to do that." Though Mitch McConnell said he would continue to support criminal cases against the rioters and stand by his unflinching criticisms of Donald Trump, the commission's defeat is likely to only embolden the former President Donald Trump at a time when he has once again ramped up circulation of his baseless and debunked claims. Republicans had already saved Donald Trump from conviction in two impeachment trials. In a matter of months, Trump's lies have warped the views of many of his party's supporters who view President Joe Biden as illegitimate. They have also inspired a rash of new voting restrictions in Republican-led states and a quixotic recount in Arizona denounced by both political parties. And they have fueled efforts by Republican members of Congress to diminish and reframe the Capitol riot as a benign event akin to a normal tourist visit. "People are just now beginning to understand," Donald Trump wrote in a statement on Thursday, 27th of May. Democrats denounced the vote and warned Republicans that preventing an independent inquiry would not shield them from confronting the implications of Donald Trump's attacks on the democratic process. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York and the majority leader in the Senate, and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi are now planning their own committee investigations into the rioting and attack on 6th of January, how it was coordinated and why the government failed to prevent an assault that left several people dead, the Capitol building ransacked, and those inside the Capitol building at risk. Nancy Pelosi could also set up a select committee focused solely on the attack, handing Democrats unilateral subpoena power and a much longer timeline to investigate whatever they want. Chuck Schumer seemingly endorsed the idea on Friday afternoon, saying it was better to investigate with a select committee than not investigate at all. Progressives seized on the Republicans' opposition to the commission as new justification to press their case for invoking the so-called nuclear option to rewrite the filibuster rule and allow bills to pass on simple majority votes. Activists have pressed Democratic leaders to do so and then skirt Republican opposition to enact pressing liberal priorities like a sweeping voting rights measure, gun control legislation, legislation of undocumented immigrants, and much more. If the Republicans can't agree to the independent commission investigating the first armed insurrection at the Capitol in our nation's history, then something has gone badly wrong, said Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat from Massachusetts. Elizabeth Warren added, and that something is the filibuster. But changing the rules would require the agreement of all 50 Democrats, and at least two oppose the move. One of them, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, said that his position was unchanged. I'm not willing to destroy our government, no, Joe Manchin said. Still, after an 11th-hour scramble with Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, to draft a compromise to address some of her party's stated concerns about the legislation, Joe Manchin concluded that most would not support it and were simply cycling through disingenuous reasons to vote no. I'm very, very disappointed, very frustrated that politics has trumped, literally and figuratively, the good of the country, he told reporters after the vote. The six Republican senators who voted to advance debate on the commission included Susan Collins, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Bob Portman of Ohio, Mitt Romney of Utah, and Ben Sasse of Nebraska. All but Rob Portman had voted at an impeachment trial in February to find Donald Trump guilty of inciting the insurrection and rioting. A seventh Republican, Senator Patrick J. Toomey of Pennsylvania, missed the vote, one of 11 senators to do so, but said he would have voted to advance debate on the commission. Bill Cassidy of Louisiana argued his party was also making a strategic mistake in blocking the commission, giving Democrats reason to pursue partisan investigations of what happened on 6th of January with or without the Republicans. To ensure the investigations are fair, impartial, and focused on the facts, Republicans need to be involved in the investigations, Bill Cassidy said. After his own flirtation with supporting the bill, Mitch McConnell worked aggressively to quash support. To convince his colleagues that Democrats were acting in bad faith despite the bipartisan nature of the commission, Mitch McConnell circulated an interview with James Carville, the Democratic strategist, urging his party to make the Republicans own that insurrection every day. It was a marked shift for Mitch McConnell, reflecting how his political calculus has changed since 6th of January. Though he made some of his party's most stinging condemnations of Donald Trump's attempt to undermine the election outcome, the minority leader has now made a clear decision that his party's fortune and his own personal fortunes depend on putting the events of 6th of January firmly behind them in favor of attacking Joe Biden's agenda. In rejecting the commission, Republicans resisted emotional appeals from those affected by the rioting to drop their opposition. The mother and longtime girlfriend of a Capitol police officer who died after clashing with the mob on 6th of January led an emotional last-ditch lobbying campaign on the eve of the vote, teaming with police officers who had responded to the assault. I couldn't stay quiet anymore, said Gladys Sicknick, the mother of police officer Brian Sicknick, who died after the 6th of January riot and assault. The group also included Michael Fanone, a Washington police officer who was brutalized by rioters and pleaded with them to spare his life, and also Harry Dunn, a Capitol police officer who is black and faced a slew of racist slurs during the attack.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The UK has called for a complete overhaul of the Northern Ireland Protocol, a key part of the Brexit agreement that Prime Minister Boris Johnson reached with the EU in 2019. On Wednesday, Brexit Minister David Frost issued a new command paper that would radically revamp the Northern Ireland Protocol, which he himself negotiated. Frost's new proposal was rejected by the EU, with the European Commission saying that we will not agree to a renegotiation of the protocol. The Northern Ireland Protocol is a main component of the Brexit withdrawal agreement, whose main goal is to maintain an open land border between Britain's Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland in order to facilitate the free movement of goods. The protocol, which only came into force in January, has led to additional checks and delays on goods entering Northern Ireland from Britain. Joining us now is our correspondent Jerome Hughes, who's with us from Brussels. Jerome, how far apart are the EU and the UK on the issue of Northern Ireland?
There's no doubt, Bardier, that they are very far apart, and really there's no sign right now of any hope in terms of them coming to some sort of a resolution. I mean, from the UK side, they're saying it's unacceptable that this Northern Ireland protocol is creating so much friction in terms of goods that are moving from Britain to Northern Ireland. And what the European Commission is saying is that, look, we are willing to examine any proposals and look at them in good faith, but it has to be within the parameters of the Northern Ireland Protocol. That the Northern Ireland Protocol is effectively the only show in town. It's an international agreement. Both sides knew exactly what was in it. And now you have a situation whereby the UK government is rowing backwards. And when you speak to senior officials here in Brussels, they have this feeling that, you know, Boris Johnson's arrogance is somewhat being fueled by the fact that he has such a big majority in Parliament. You remember the 2019 landslide victory that he had during the general election, and actually increased the number of seats, Tory seats, by 48. And now they have a majority of 80 seats in the House of Commons. And before that, you had Theresa May's government, which was being propped up by the DUP. So Northern Ireland unionists had a big say in what went on. In fact, they were able to scupper an agreement she reached with Brussels because they felt that there was a situation where there was this status being given to Northern Ireland, and effectively it made them less British. They consider themselves completely British. They don't want anything that aligns themselves more closely with the Republic of Ireland and the EU vis-a-vis the rest of the UK. And so they had power when Theresa May was in power. But with Boris Johnson, they don't have that. So Boris Johnson is able to, he feels he's very politically strong. And on paper, that's, there's no doubt about that, that he is. But unionists feel disenfranchised. And the European Union considers Boris Johnson and his government to be completely unreliable, completely untrustworthy, that anything that they actually do agree that, you know, the UK side could back down at any point. And you've never seen relations so bad between the EU and the UK. Don't forget, it's not that long ago, the UK was a member of the European Union, a strong member of the EU. Now they just see, they look more and more like enemies. And, you know, one of the bad situations here, it could be a situation whereby you could have an all-out trade war between the EU and the UK. But perhaps the worst-case scenario, Bardia, would be if we saw a situation of violence breaking out in Northern Ireland, because the patience of unionists is running out. Okay, we don't have a hard border yet between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, but even so, this fact that this status has been given to Northern Ireland, which just differentiates it from the rest of the UK, unionists just are not happy about that at all.
All right, thanks a lot, Jerome Hughes, joining us from Brussels. Well, joining us, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsenopoulos, joining us from the British capital, London. And also writer and political analyst John White is joining us from Edinburgh. Well, let's start off with Mr. Saeed Mohsenopoulos from the British capital, London. Mr. Abbas, welcome to Spotlight. Britain has demanded that the EU overhauls the Northern Ireland Protocol just a year after it was agreed. Why have the Tories changed their tune on the NI Protocol?
I think what partly your reporter said, that there is an arrogance and there's a sense that Britain can do what it likes within this government that they have in office at the moment. It's very, very unrealistic, but they are constantly pushing and hustling for breaking of more and more rules and regulations that they've agreed to. I mean, this has become a track record. You know, the latest one is obviously laughably started off with a row over sausages, but that's kind of a red herring. You know, there has been a whole situation where the proposed ban on fresh British, Great British sausages in Northern Ireland could effectively be banned. But that's a bit of a red herring, because there are, according to Northern Ireland businesses themselves, much bigger problems that are looming. And even though this ban is due to take effect, this protocol is due to take effect in October, it seems that these looming problems are increasing. And the central one is the amount of administration needed for actually shifting food from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. Of course, they're meant to do the checks now at the Northern Ireland border, which prevented them that happening at the Northern Ireland Ireland border, which actually, of course, has disturbed the unionists as well, those people who don't want to see any shifting of the relationship of Northern Ireland with Britain. So they've started murmuring, of course, saying that anything that looks like they have to be creating any kind of nominal border between mainland Britain and Northern Ireland for them is a red line. And so, of course, there have been allegations of threats being made to people in the export sort of section there on the coastlines. But in reality, it's kind of a perfect storm that people are arguing is building up. But normally, I mean, food products entering the single market require a complicated piece of administration, and that's known as the Export Health Certificate, EHC. But supermarkets currently don't need those for most products moving from GB to Northern Ireland. That's due to change in October, which will effectively be part of a perfect storm. And that's what people are really worried about. What are the consequences of this, really, as to what will happen beyond October?
Let's cross over to John White in Edinburgh. Mr. White, the EU, they immediately rejected the call coming from Britain, saying that Britain needed to respect its international obligations, and pointed out that had been negotiated by Prime Minister Boris Johnson. This wasn't imposed on Britain. It was an agreement that was negotiated. Why doesn't London want to honour its own handiwork?
Well, a government that fails or refuses to abide by its obligations enshrined in internationally binding agreements instantly becomes a government of a pariah state, and that's what Brexit has ushered into being. Britain is now a pariah state. Boris Johnson lied in the run-up to the 2019 election when he said there will be frictionless trade between the EU and the island of Ireland, and now he is sowing dragon's teeth. He is trying to play to his newly acquired red wall working class base in the deindustrialised north and midlands of England and South Wales, and he's going to dial up the xenophobia, the anti-Europe xenophobia, the base British nationalism. Look out for the Churchillian rhetoric and the references to the Second World War. This is a government of rogues, and it's a government of rogues brought into being by a nation of sheep, in the words of Edward R. Murrow. The EU is doing nothing wrong here. It's only asking for the UK government, led by Boris Johnson, to abide by its agreement. There was no coercion. There was no sleight of hand. It was agreed in the context of the Brexit negotiations in 2018-2019, and the Britain already is trying to break those agreements in order to assuage a unionist rump in the north of Ireland that has nothing to offer the people of that province other than sectarianism, other than bigotry. That is where we are now.
Sayyid Mustafa Abbas, let's go over some comments from the British Business Secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, said on Thursday, a deal is a deal, but it wasn't something that was going to last forever. He also claimed the agreement wasn't written in stone. Well, they don't write agreements in stone anymore. It was written into international law. Unpack these comments for us, please.
Again, it's slithery comments. They're kind of really get-out techniques which politicians use very, very regularly when they don't want to abide by international rule of law. You see, of course, Donald Trump, Britain's partner across the West Asia, has been breaking these laws. It's become a kind of a precedent that's been set, unilaterally pulling out of trade deals, not agreeing things. I mean, it seems like Britain definitely is catching that habit from the Americans. And I think the problem with what they're doing, of course, is added to what's going on with COVID-19 and the exodus of a lot of the immigrant workforce at the ground level, what you're seeing is a dangerous accumulation of factors which could actually impact on supplies to supermarkets in Britain. I mean, if they continue as they are, what with this kind of business with Brexit and adding to the problems that they potentially got, there are already murmurings that the army may be on standby to have to deliver certain foods, because a lot of the vegetables and the market place is suffering because of potential lack of drivers even being able to take products to goods. So the last thing Britain really needs is more headaches like this. But under the protocol, it was agreed that Northern Ireland would continue to follow EU rules on product standards to prevent checks along the border. Checks would instead take place on goods entering Northern Ireland, as I said. But the bottom line is the agreement, the British government is clearly trying to renege on all of this. They want a complete new negotiation. The EU is saying we're not having any of it. What we've got in terms of the protocol, we're going to do everything within those boundaries. There is an Article 16 locked within the protocol, which does allow for some flexibility in terms of extenuating circumstances that may arise due to economics and other factors. But, and funny enough, the EU almost exercised Article 16 in terms of changing some of the agreement they had within this protocol. And they did that over COVID-19, the passing of COVID-19 vaccines. In the end, they pulled back pretty sharpish because there was a bit of a hue and cry. So Europe didn't go for it. But Britain certainly is. They're trying to trigger this Article 16, saying, look, it's part of the protocol that we're allowed to do this. But the game behind this really is more of a we don't care about Europe And I think that in the long run, this isolationism that Britain seems to be heading in terms of, at least with Europe, will only make their own trading more and more difficult, given the constant threat of COVID-19 new strains coming out all the time, shutdowns of the economy, closures of the high streets, etc.
Mr. White in Edinburgh, Boris Johnson's government, he's warned that it will suspend parts of the agreement if the EU doesn't budge. The EU has threatened trade sanctions if Johnson unilaterally breaks his promises. If this row escalates any further, are we looking at the possibility of what many are labeling right now as a mini trade war?
Yes, but this will play politically into the hands of Boris Johnson and his administration, because this will dial up the anti-Europe xenophobia. This will play into the hands of the narrative that Britain has been put upon by this monolithic, tyrannical Brussels bureaucracy. And this will play well with the Brexit heartlands that has propelled him into power in 2019 and continues to maintain his popularity regardless of all the scandals and the crises ushered into being by his failed policy on on COVID. So Boris Johnson will seek to extrapolate as much political capital from this as possible. Brexit was always an emotionally driven political project. It was never about reason, it was never about rationality, it was never about bread and butter issues. It was all about a supposed reach, emotional reach back in time to a golden age where Britain ruled the waves, Britannia ruled the waves, and the Union Jack flew wherever it damn well pleased. Boris Johnson has more political acumen than his detractors would have us believe, and he understands base nationalism is a very, very powerful, powerful political force, and he's going to play to that in regards to his opposition to the EU on the Northern Ireland Protocol.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. White. The rising cost of Brexit for Britain was divulged on Thursday as a new analysis showed quitting the EU had delivered an £18 billion blow to UK trade in goods. Now, if this impasse does continue, how will this affect the British economy?
Well, it will obviously affect it deleteriously, but this was never about economics, as I just said. This was all about emotion. It was about the legitimization of far-right tropes regarding British identity, immigration, and the representation and meaning of British history. It is the acme of British mythologies regarding British history and regarding Britain's place in the world. So it's never been about economics, it's been about base nationalism, and it's a very, very dangerous motive force indeed.
Mr. Abbas, Ireland, it isn't where the line is drawn, pun intended there, as Gibraltar remains an issue in post-Brexit talks. Gibraltar's border with Spain, like that between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, is a divide between the EU and a non-EU Britain. What if the provisions of that temporary deal between the UK and Spain come into question?
Well, that does flare up very regularly, and I think it's being kept in check because of wheeling and dealing and behind-the-scenes negotiations. So it's still very much a vulnerable area, just as the Northern Ireland situation is. These are all flashpoints, and one does get the feeling that somebody somewhere certainly is quite happy to engineer these flashpoints, because all of this would bring back the old rule Britannia kind of mentality, and that is something which the Tories have definitely been stoking. They would be quite happy with Britain having a kind of a nationalistic, if you like, outlook and being more united. Don't forget that they're also internally battling the idea of Scottish independence, and the idea of Welsh independence has reared its head, and that the Scottish independence certainly hasn't gone away. In fact, it's gathering more pace. So Boris would need anything he can to try and sort of keep Britain together, because there's, of course, that threat of fragmentation of Britain due to Brexit, because the Scots aren't terribly happy with the way that England is certainly approaching the whole Brexit question. So yes, there are many, many issues which are really about territorial fragmentation, which Boris is risking as well. He would say that actually he's creating a rallying cry for a unified United Kingdom, and they're all for this kind of bringing back the old jingoism of empire days, almost, if they could. I mean, if it was down to Boris, he certainly would, but there's a limit to what they can do. It's manifesting on the street, of course, in Islamophobia, in a rise in racism. You saw, even with the English football players just recently, that the minute the English football players missed a bunch of penalties, and they happened to be black, there was a huge storm on social media in which there were racists who came out very openly attacking those black players. And of course there's been a response, and it doesn't mean that everybody in Britain is racist, but this issue of xenophobia, this issue of racism, this issue of nationalism, as my colleague pointed out, is a major factor in winning political votes in the heartlands. And so perhaps that is more important to Boris than Britain's economic future. He probably won't be here when the real consequences of Brexit kick in, which will be that Britain will certainly not have as much wealth passing through it as it did, given the trade it had with the EU.
Let's get a final thought from Mr. White. Is Boris Johnson's recent Asian presence, both the diplomacy push and also the announced South China Sea military deployments, do you think they're intended to divert attention from some of these post-Brexit uncertainties?
Absolutely. This is the politics of mass distraction. This is desperation. This is an attempt by Boris Johnson to assert Britain's stature on the world stage post-Brexit, trying to hark back to the ghosts of Britain's imperial past. But the great Labour leftist Nye Bevan said it best. A reactionary is a man walking backwards with his face to the future. I can think of no better summation of Brexit in our time. Britain is a post-colonial theme park, a 19th century post-colonial theme park, and in poetic irony, rather than ushering a new golden age for British imperial prestige on a world stage, it has only ushered in the coming breakup of the UK. And when that day comes, such a cry of freedom will ring out around the world, such as never been heard before.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, joining us from the British capital, London, and also thanks to writer and political analyst, John White, speaking to us from Edinburgh. Also, thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now. Thank you.
in the limelight.
A theory as to why children generally appear less susceptible to the coronavirus than adults is that they have less of a type of receptor known as ACE2 in their respiratory tract. These receptors are a key pathway for the entry of the virus that causes COVID-19 to enter the cells. It is theorized fewer ACE2 receptors means fewer opportunities for the virus to take hold. We have prepared for you an article written by Melissa Davey. The piece is titled Children with COVID, Why Are Some Countries Seeing More Cases and Deaths? The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Emergency physicians and leading epidemiologist in Brazil, Dr. Fatima Marinho, is seeing symptoms of COVID-19 in children that starkly contrast with the message that has been relayed globally throughout the pandemic, that children do not appear to suffer severely from the coronavirus. Dr. Fatima Marinho says severe muscle aches, diarrhea, coughing, abdominal pain, and hospitalization, all of these are happening to children with COVID-19 in Brazil. The latest available data, extracted by Marinho on 15th of April, showed 2,216 children aged between 0 and 9 had died from COVID-19. This includes 1,397 babies under the age of 1. Meanwhile, more than 67,000 children in the 0 to 9 years old age group have been hospitalized in Brazil. Dr. Fatima Marinho, a senior advisor to the global public health organization Vital Strategies, tells the Guardian newspaper the epidemic in Brazil is changing the profile of severe cases. She says, we see more young people hospitalized and dying by COVID compared to 2020. She added, soon Brazil must start to vaccinate young people because of the risk due to the new variants of the virus, but there isn't enough vaccine. On Saturday, 22nd of May, the World Health Organization, WHO, urged wealthier countries who had completed vaccinating their most vulnerable to delay vaccinating children and instead donate those vaccine doses to its COVAX facility so they can be distributed to countries most in need. Vaccinations of children has already begun in some countries, with Canada and the United States among those vaccinating 12 to 15-year-olds. Health Organization's Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said, in low and lower middle-income countries, COVID-19 vaccine supply has not been enough to even immunize healthcare workers, and hospitals are being inundated with people that need life-saving care urgently. He added, I understand why some countries want to vaccinate their children and adolescents, but right now I urge them to reconsider and to instead donate those vaccines to the COVAX program. But among those requiring life-saving care in countries still being ravaged by the virus, including India, Brazil, and Indonesia, are children. So why is COVID-19 infecting and affecting children so severely in some countries, but not in others, to the point where some countries may forego vaccinating children for the time being? While more research is needed, Dr. Fatima Marinho says there are several factors playing a role. One is that diagnosis of COVID-19 in children is coming too late, when children are already severely unwell and treatment is more difficult. She says there is a culture of there is no risk for children, so physicians don't think in terms of COVID-19, adding, as well as low access to timely healthcare, there is also poverty and inequalities involved. and people living in areas and houses with difficulty in social distancing. In poor houses, there are more than four people per room. Marina says social distancing outside the home is also difficult. She says members of the family must go out every day for work or searching for a job. She added, new SARS-CoV-2 variants also have a higher viral load compared to other variants. This means people are also more infectious. She noted that Brazil needs more tests for COVID-19. Without testing and tracking cases and controls, the virus cannot be controlled and will continue spreading around the country. The risk is new mutations of the virus. In Indonesia, the Indonesian Pediatrician Association said official figures that suggest 28 children have died from COVID are an underestimate, and the true number is closer to 160. The Indonesian Pediatrician Association chairman, Dr. Aman Pulungan, told the ABC in June, "It proves that it is not true that the under 18 age bracket is not susceptible to COVID-19. In India, not only have children been left orphaned due to the high COVID-19 death rate, but the devastating second wave is seeing more children infected. While child mortality is still low overall, they are being hit more severely." Dr. Srikanta JT, a pediatric pulmonologist working in Bangalore, India, says during the previous wave of COVID, there might be one child a week with COVID. He tells The Guardian newspaper, "But according to data from most health centers in India and our own data collected over the last few months, the second wave seems to be impacting children quite significantly, with numbers gradually increasing with almost 12 to 15 positive cases a day. These include young children and adolescents. While most children seem to have asymptomatic to mildly infections, which could be managed at home, there is a growing number of severe cases in children." Dr. Srikanta JT added, "We're also witnessing a significant number of severe cases, like severe pneumonia requiring ventilatory support to children presenting with type 1 diabetes mellitus and complications of it like diabetic ketoacidosis to multi-system inflammatory syndrome with significant morbidity and mortality. Even though it quantifies to approximately 5% of our cohort, the numbers are quite significant. As well as the role of underlying conditions that are more common in children living in harsh conditions, Dr. Srikanta says once lockdowns and other restrictions were lifted following the first wave of coronavirus, there was a sense in the general public that the pandemic was behind them." He says, "And most started either completely or partially refraining from COVID-appropriate behavior," adding, "This inappropriate behavior has led to significant intermingling and hence a second wave of the virus." A theory as to why children generally appear less susceptible to the coronavirus than adults is that they have less of a type of receptor known as ACE2 in their respiratory tract. These receptors are a key pathway for the entry of the virus that causes COVID-19 to enter human cells. It is theorized that fewer ACE2 receptors means fewer opportunities for the virus to take hold. Dr. Srikanta says, "During the first wave of the pandemic, it was generally thought that both absence and reduced numbers of these receptors in children was generally protective," adding, "But along came the second wave with a more virulent strain, which seems to bypass the apparatus required for entry and evade the immune system better, hence an increase in both numbers in children and severity in infection." The latest World Health Organization COVID-19 epidemiological report says the highest numbers of new cases reported in the week to 11th of May were from India, where 2,738,957 new cases, a 5% increase, was reported, followed by Brazil, where 423,438 new cases was reported, similar to the previous week. Indonesia had the third highest number of new cases in the Southeast Asia region, behind India and Nepal, with 36,882 new cases reported, a 2% increase under week prior. Robert Boy, a professor of paediatrics and child health at the University of Sydney in Australia, says the sheer population size of those countries is also likely behind the higher cases in children there. He says whether variants or other mechanisms, such as the one involving ACE2 receptors described by Dr. Srikanta, are driving the rates in children needs more study. He says, as this virus keeps mutating, it carries the risk of becoming much more transmissible, which is the primary thing we've noticed in the last 6 months, but it may actually become more severe for children. He added, we just don't know everything there is to know yet.